It's going to be a fun shiur today. Hopefully, we have a lot to cover, and this is going to be the week of Shaul's glory. Right, last week we had Shaul and the donkeys, and this week is going to be Shaul's real one moment in the sun. So, you know, what we emphasized, I think, last time we talked about the signs that Shmuel told Shaul he's going to see. The theme that they all had in common was the emphasis on growth and on transformation. The way the people were relating to Shaul successively. The first group tells him about his donkeys, where he is right now. The second group tells him, gives him presents. They give him a mincha, which, as we'll see later on in this parak, is exactly the treatment they give him once he's king. So he goes from where he is now to being king. The third level, he's going to prophesy, right? Which means that Shaul's ultimate potential is that he can become a Navi. The places where Shaul is going to go. So we realize that they all are associated with transformation. Kever Rachel, the first one, is where Binyamin's name was changed from Ben Oni to Binyamin. Then we have Basel, which is where Yaakov's name was changed from Yaakov to Yisrael. And then Shaul is going to end up at this third place, Givat Elokim, where Shaul himself is going to be transformed. So even though we saw, and this is really important, that you know when we were first introduced to Shaul, so we saw the strengths, but we also saw the weaknesses. And there are a lot of potential pratfalls and reasons why Shaul could come up short. The potential to grow is there, and we should not think that you know Hashem chose someone as king who could not have succeeded. He wasn't there now, but the potential for growth was there. The question is going to be, what is Shaul going to do with the opportunity that he is given? And what we're going to see in Parak Yud Aleph, Shaul's first real story as king, is going to be an unbelievable realization of all of that latent potential, which is only going to make it more tragic that ultimately things are going to fall apart. But at the beginning, the story we're going to have at the beginning is going to show that Shaul could have indeed tapped that potential. He could have transcended the weaknesses that he did indeed bring to the table. So let's load up the source sheet. Have it right here. There's a lot. I'd love if we can cover the end of Parak Yud and Parak Yud Aleph all in one here today. Hopefully we'll do it. But if not, you know, always more time next week. So we left off last week in the middle of Parak Yud, where Shmuel and Shaul are meeting, and Shmuel is telling Shaul, here is what you're going to see when you go home. And in Pasuk Tes, so the Navi says that indeed Shaul transforms. The Navi says, Vayafoch lo Elokim lev acher, Vayavo kolo sosa ela bayomhu. All the signs that Shmuel said were going to happen, and Hashem gave Shaul a new heart. The Malbim actually has a very nice comment about this. He explains that the heart of a king is different, because before Shaul had just been an individual, but now he is responsible for the entire nation. So it's almost like he himself has become the heart of the nation. He bears the responsibilities of everyone. That's a line that the Malbim has on this comment. But Shaul is transforming. Now, Pasuk Yud Yud Aleph Yud Beis, Shaul meets the Nevi'im. He gets to give Asa. He gets to the Givat Elokim. The Mefarshim said that that's probably Kiryat Yarim. That's the place where the Aron has been kept ever since the Plishtim brought it back. Now he says, "V'hinei chevel neviim likraso." A band of neviim comes to greet him. Let's remember, this is Shmuel's contribution, because at the beginning of Sefer Shmuel, the Navi said no one was talking to Hashem. There was no communication between Hashem and the people. There was total alienation. Shmuel comes along and restores the connection. And now you have bands of Nevi'im who are running around. So here is one of them. And then an amazing thing happens. Shaul becomes a Navi. The spirit of Hashem rests on Shaul, and he begins to prophesy. Some of the parshim say, Shavach, right? It's like, you know, praise, like Ruach HaKodesh. If you imagine Tehillim, right? Which is Shavach, praise to Hashem, which is said with Ruach HaKodesh, so that maybe is what Shaul is doing here as well. Divinely inspired, breaking forth into praise of Hashem. something we associate more with David, interestingly. But here, that's what's happening with Shaul. He's able to achieve the level of Ruach HaKodesh. He's able to become a Navi. Now, the Navi continues, Pasuk Yud Aleph, but he called Yod Ome at Mol Shel Shom. So people knew Shaul beforehand. He's the son of a prominent person in the tribe of Binyamin. He's not an unknown quantity. Vayiru hinei im neviim niba. He's with the prophets, and that's surprising. Vayomer ha'am ish arei ehu. Ma zahaya leven kish agam Shaul ba'neviim. What's up with the son of Kish? A little bit of a derogatory line. Is Shaul one of the neviim? Pasuk Yibayz is not so clear. We'll have to look at Rashi. Rashi makes a very important comment. Pasuk says, "Vayan ish misham vayomer, umi avihem." Who is the father of the prophets? So, what's going on with that? Who's the father of the prophets? So, Rashi explains the people were, especially some of the Nevi'im here, were saying, "Hey, Shaul is not a Navi, and he doesn't come from a family of Nevi'im. Kish isn't a Navi. Shaul's, how does Shaul jump the line and become a Navi?" So the response to that was, I'll scroll down, we'll look at what Rashi says, and we think in terms of the framework, the leadership framework of Sefer Shmuel, we'll see the importance. Rashi says down here, who is their father? Ma timalach badavar, mi aviyam shal neviyim. Why are you bothered wondering who is the father of the prophets? V'chi nevua yerushahi, is prophecy an inheritance? Hashem communicates with whoever he deems worthy. It's a meritocracy. It doesn't matter who you're a child of. This is in contrast with the two other forms of leadership that we have in Sefer Shmuel. The kahuna, Eli, the sons of Eli, the priesthood, that's hereditary. The kingship, the model that B'nai Yisrael right now are in the middle of wanting to transition to, that's also hereditary. If you're not the son of the king, you're not going to be the king. It's this third model, the model that Shmuel himself has personified, the one that B'nai Yisrael want to abandon, right, that the Navi here is reminding us is the one that's available to anybody. Anybody can be a Navi, provided that they achieve the requisite level. So here Shaul is being chosen as the king, is also achieving the level of Shmuel. He is becoming a Navi. We're reminded of the advantage of that model. Then the end of the Pasuk, which if we think about it, has a bit of a dark tinge, says, Al-Kain Haysalim Mashal Hagam Shaul Banviyim. This is where that saying came from. Everyone knows the popular saying, is Shaul one of the Neviim? So the Navi tells us that, you know, that popular saying, is Shaul from the Neviim, comes from this pasuk. So I guess the way it would work would be if you saw something surprising, or you saw someone, I don't know, you know, they saw me on the somehow sneaking onto the varsity basketball team where I did not belong. So they would have seen me there. They would have said, Hagam Shaul Banviyim, right? That doesn't fit. What's a little bit dark about that is that what this hints for us is that even though here in the beginning of Shaul's career in Perek Yud, he is becoming a Navi, that is not going to stick, right? Because if it would have stuck, then there never would have been a common saying, Hagam Shaul Banviyim. Like Shmuel got surprising prophecy in Perek Gimel, but there was no saying, Hagam Shmuel Banviyim, because yeah, right? Shmuel becomes a regular Navi. So we have a hint that's dropped in here already at this early stage that even though at the beginning, Shaul is tapping into some of the potential he has, going from donkeys to melech, to he even can become a Navi, it's not going to stick. And we're just going to be left at the end of the day with this saying, Hagam Shaul Banviyim. It doesn't really fit. But at least in this moment here in time, the potential was there. Okay. So the Navi then continues, Vaychal Mehis Navos. So Shaul ends his time giving Nevuah. Vayavo HaBama, he goes to the Mizbeach. Remember, the Mefarshim think that he's in Kiryat Yarim, so the Arun is there, there was a Mizbeach there. So it makes sense, he goes to the Bama. I'm not sure what he probably gives them some of the bread that he was given by one of the people who he ran into on the way. And then he goes, home. So he gets home. Pasuk Gedalah by Yomer Dod Shaul Elav Ve'el Ne'aro. Whether this is Shaul's uncle, that Mikra suggests it might mean Shaul's friend. Peter's uncle or his friend, he gets home and someone asks him, Unhalachtem, where do you go? Remember, they've been gone for a long time. Shaul had been telling his Na'ar, where our father, my father is going to be worried about us. Chazal gave him credit for saying that he'll be worried about us. In reality, he's only worried about Shaul. But they're gone for a long time. So he asks, where were you? We went to look for the donkeys. We couldn't find the donkeys, so we went to Shmuel. What's interesting about that is that at the beginning of Parak Tes, the whole time that Shaul referred to Shmuel, he never referred to him by name. Remember, it always was the Ro'eh. The seer is in town. Let's go to the seer. Can we bring something to the seer? Now, instead of just referring to Shmuel as the Ro'eh, Shaul refers to him by name. This is the first time it's going to happen in Sefer Shmuel. The relationship between these two, which is going to define both of them for the rest of their lives, really. We have Shaul referring to Shmuel by name. There's a relationship. There's already, we can sense some transformation in Shaul's personality. He's no longer like, you know, there to hear to Shmuel. But you know what's interesting is you can kind of recreate the scene, and it almost sounds like Shaul isn't actually sure what he wants to tell his dode. And it says, we couldn't find the donkeys, so we went to Shmuel. And then he stops talking. So then Pasuk says, Vav, Navi says, Vayomer dod Shaul, nu, Agida Nali. Okay, what does Shmuel say? Now you can like picture the scene. You know, Shaul, he gets to the part where, you know, where I came to Shmuel, then he stops talking. So his uncle says, nu, so what happened? And Shaul, it sounds like he's not sure what to say, and he ends up holding back. Pasuk says, Zayin Vayomer Shaul al dado, Agid hi gidlano ki nimtzeu asanos. He told us the donkeys were found. Period. That's it. Nothing else happened at the meeting. The es devar hamlucha lo hi gidlo asher amar Shmuel. He did not tell him the matter about, you know, that the small print that Shmuel told me I was going to become king. Now that line, think about Megillas Esther. There's a strong association with Esther there, right? Who would not tell her nationality. So here too, you have Shaul, who's not revealing the secret of the royalty. You know, we could think about that, but not for now. At least the point for now is that Shaul, he's still trying to process this moment. He's not sure what to tell, what not to tell. He feels that he has to keep this inside of him. But you could like sense there's, even though there's a lot that's happened to him and he's changed a lot in the last couple of days, this is still a whirlwind, and he's still trying to absorb what's going on, and he does not feel comfortable yet sharing what happened. So now the Navi cut scene, right? Now we cut back. Because if we think about the broader structure of the Sefer, so in Perek Ches, the people asked Shmuel for a king. And then Perek Ches ended with Shmuel saying, okay, you'll get one, but not now. It's going to happen eventually. Then everyone went home. Presumably everyone's waiting every day. They're checking the newspapers. Is Shmuel announcing the king? Is Shmuel announcing the king? Nothing happened. We had the whole story of Shmuel and Shaul, which took a parak and a half. Parak Tes, the first half of Parak Yud. And now we cut back. So the Navi says, Vayatzik Shmuel al ha'am al Hashem ha-mitzvah. So Shmuel calls everyone together. They're going to be specifically in front of Hashem. We're choosing a king who's, you know, the whole point of a king is that Shmuel does not want him replacing Hashem, even though he sort of is. We're going to have that constant tension. What's the relationship between the Melech Basar Adam and the Melech Malchei Hamlachim? And Shmuel brings them to mitzvah. Now that's a very interesting place for Shmuel to choose. Shmuel choosing mitzvah. Because we saw Shmuel gather everybody in mitzvah earlier. In Perek Zion, when Bnei Yisrael were still completely occupied by the Plishtim, that one parak where we saw Shmuel's leadership in action, Shmuel also brought them to Mitzvah. And then as soon as they got there, the Plishtim came and there was a battle right there, and Shmuel set up a monument, Evan HaEzer, to document the victory. That's one place where we saw Mitzvah. And then at the time, we pointed out that Mitzvah had come up somewhere else. Mitzvah had been where Bnei Israel had gathered when they fought the civil war with Binyamin in the story of Pilegesh Begiva that we saw in our introduction to Sefer Shoftim, to Sefer Shmuel, sorry. So at the time, we suggested that this was Shmuel trying to undo that terrible nadir of the story of Pilegesh Begiva. Last time, we all got together at Mitzvah, civil war. This time, we're all getting together at Mitzvah to redeem Bnei Yisrael from the oppression of the Plishtim. So he's bringing everyone to the same spot. And this is, remember, this what's happening here is Shmuel is being replaced as a leader. So the place he chooses to bring them is the place that will recall Shmuel's greatest moment, the place which will recall Hashem's miraculous salvation of the people. You literally have the monument of Evan HaEzer right there, the giant monument to the victory over the Plishtim that they had. That's the place that Shmuel chooses to establish the monarchy, because we're trying to thread this needle of giving them a king, but also not abandoning the whole legacy of Shmuel and the whole legacy and the realization that Hashem is Melech Malchei Hamlachim. We're going to try to have both. You can have a Melech Basar Vedam, but it has to be one who recognizes that Hashem is still ultimately in charge. So to try to preserve that, let's bring them back to the place of Shmuel's greatest hits, to bring them back to Mitzvah. Okay, so Shmuel then talks to Bnei Yisrael, and he tells them, you know, here's what Hashem has to say. I brought you out of Egypt, and you rejected Hashem. You want a king. Shmuel's still not happy about that. You know, he hasn't moved on. He still thinks he's correct. Hashem told him he was correct, but you're getting a king anyway. Okay, so you want a king, so now we're going to have one. Hisyatzvu lifnei Hashem, stand before God, l'shivteichem u'alfeichem. Now, this scene sounds an awful lot like the division of the land in Sefer Yehoshua between the tribes. And in fact, the Mefarshim assume that when the Navi here says that Shmuel gathered everyone together before Hashem, they assume that it means that the Kohen Gadol was there with the Urim Bitumim. And just like the Urim Bitumim were used and lots were drawn to divide up Eretz Yisrael, so the exact same thing is going to happen here. They use the Urim Bitumim and they file down who's going to become the king. So first the Pasuk says, Shevet Binyamin. And then we say the family of Shevet Binyamin, the family of Matri, and then Shaul ben Kish. Finally, right, we get there all the way down to Shaul ben Kish, using apparently the Urim Bitumim, although no mention of a Kohen. That'll be another example of Shmuel, who's, you know, we never mention Kohanim when Shmuel's around. It's almost like Shmuel has invisibly kind of replaced the Kohen. He hasn't actually. But we just don't talk about Kohanim when Shmuel's around. Then the most amazing thing, Shaul's not there. So this is the famous line. They ask, where is Shaul? And Hashem says, "Behinehu nechbal hakelim." That amazing image of Shaul hiding with the baggage. Everyone who had slept over to Mitzvah, so you know they dumped their suitcases at the front door, and then they discover Shaul hiding there. And you know, in addition to the image of Shaul hiding with the baggage, the Navi reminds us that the man's, you know, 6'6", right? So it's the tallest man there who's trying to put himself down, shrinking with the baggage. Is that good or bad for Shaul? Both, right? It shows his humility. Rashi emphasizes that is, yes, he's hiding. It also shows there's something alarming here, right? Not a natural leader. Okay, so the Navi says that he's tall. Shmuel tells the people, you see the people Hashem has chosen. Look, he's so visually impressive. Again, that leaves us uncomfortable because the whole theme in Perek Tes in Shaul's introduction was that appearances could be deceiving. The word ri'iyah being used again and again in contrast to shmia. So the good news is Shaul looks the part of a leader. People are impressed by his physical presence, but we're wary of that. Okay, and then to close out the parak by Deber Shmuel al Ha'am Eis Mishpah HaMlucha, Shmuel tells everyone the halachos of a king. He talked about those in Parak Ches. Now he formally teaches those to the people. By Yichtov Basefer Vayarach Lefnei Hashem, he writes them down in a book, and it sounds like he leaves them with. I guess ultimately they're left with the Aron Kodesh. You know, if the Kohen Gadol is there, he can bring them back to the Aron Kodesh. That sounds an awful lot like Moshe Rabbeinu. Yeah, Shmuel's doing a law giving. So we have the Sefer Torah. Yehoshua did something like that at the end of Sefer Yehoshua. His Moshe Rabbeinu moment where his Musar he writes up and it's left with the Aron at the end of Sefer Yehoshua. And here Shmuel does the same thing. So this is another example. We've had so, so many. But another example of Shmuel following in Moshe's path, right? We've had him as a leader. We've had him as a prophet. Here we have him as a formal lawgiver, writing the Sefer. And then Shmuel sends everyone home. Pasuk Vav, Navi says, Shaul also goes home. Givasa, he goes back home to Giva, that place of Pilagash for Giva. And the people, you know, the more impressive people went home with him. What's a little interesting about this is that the image you get is that Shaul goes home unchanged. Right? You just okay, I woke up in the morning, you know, we got together, I was chosen to be king. You know, now what happens? I just go home. You know, in the prime minister's Yehuda Avner's book, so he has a great moment where after all those years in politics, Menachem Begin becomes prime minister, and he's sitting in the office the first day, and he's like, okay, now what? You know, so I won the election. What does prime minister actually do? You know, I'm not the defense minister, so I'm in charge of the army. I'm not the foreign minister. What do I actually do right now? So you kind of have that image, like Shaul's been chosen as king, but he doesn't sound any different. Now, Dot Maker points out that it doesn't actually seem like Shaul literally went back to his old house, because we're going to see in a couple of psukim that Shaul is now living in the capital city of Givat Shaul. So it sounds like in reality, he's going to his new house. But I think it's very telling that the Navi presents it, making it sound like he's just going back home. This moment where he's supposedly been crowned king, it hasn't really changed him. He still inside is a Nechba El HaKelem personality. He does not feel comfortable with this. He does not feel like a real king. He's a king in name only. And sure enough, not everyone accepts him. Pasach Chav Zayin, the Bnei Blial Amru, and there are some people who are not impressed with Shaul, and they didn't give him anything. But he was quiet. Vahikimacharish. Now, this term Bnei Blial, that's a really loaded term for us in Sefer Shmuel. Going back to the beginning of the book, remember, that came up twice. Chana told Eli, do not think I am a Bas Blial, Bliol, someone who has overthrown the yoke. And the sons of Eli were, then we called them Bnei Blial. Are you someone who throws off the yoke or are you not? And that fundamental split we had in the beginning of the Sefer, which is going to run through the whole thing, between Chana and Bnei Eli. Shmuel and Chana and Bnei Eli. So where we are right now, by bringing back that term Bnei Blial, so that's bringing all that back. And we seem to be putting Shaul on the side of Chana and Shmuel. That's good. And he's being opposed by the Bnei Blial. So if that, if we're right, and I think we're going to see this more clearly in the next parak. But the Navi is evoking this idea that this key question we have, are you in the world of Chana? Are you in the world of Bnei Eli? So right now, that division is being brought back.
I have a question. I have a question.
Yeah.
And this is a question that's bothered me actually for a long time. Every time I learn this, and I never asked it. At this point, Shaul was king for 3 years, 4 years.
How long was he king in total?
Yeah.
Shaul. It's a good question. We're going to have to talk about that.
Okay.
There's one place in the classic that says 2 years, which is very hard to.
Right. That's hard to understand. But my question is, at this point, he's not a nar. He's not a young kid. He's not even a young married. He's a man who supposedly has established a family. Yonatan certainly has been born at this point and has grown up. So I'm trying to sort of understand a timeline.
Right.
I don't know why, but this has always bothered me.
So I'm trying. The Abarbanel thought that he was probably right now. He could be in his mid to late 20s. That's how old Abarbanel thought he was right now. And he's married, and he has children. But you know, can be in his 20s, maybe, or maybe early 30s. But he's a young man. He's a young man who still, remember, he still is being introduced. His father is still the head of the household.
Right.
He's really looking for his father's donkeys. So. You know, it doesn't sound like he's much much older than that.
Well, but Prince Charles still is under his mother's
thumb. That's true. You're right. Yeah. Yeah. Didn't work out for him.
or an so, extreme example of a hot deal. But...
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So Perek, then we transition to Perek Yud Aleph, and this is going to be the great moment of Shaul's triumph. So we're thrown a curveball, because until now we've been thinking that the primary enemy B'nai Yisrael have are the Plishtim. So out of nowhere, and we'll have to understand what on earth is going on. The Navi says, "Vayal Nachash Ha'amoni." So Nachash, the king of Ammon, on the other side of the Jordan River, right? So that's in the east. The Plishtim are in the west, near the Mediterranean. The Yichan al Yavesh Gilad, he camped against Yavesh Gilad. They say, give us terms and we'll serve you. They feel isolated from the rest of the people. We'll look at the map in a second and see what's going on. Cut out, pierce your right eye, and then I will let you go. This is going to be an embarrassment, for a disgrace for all of Israel. Bizarre. Where is this coming from? Why is he attacking Yavesh Gilad? Why is he demanding that they pierce their right eye? What on earth is going on? And then Pasuk Gimel makes it even stranger. So the elders of Yavesh told Nachash, this king, give us 7 days. We'll send messengers to all of Israel. No one comes to save us, we'll go out to you. So, and apparently Nachash says yes. Why on earth does he agree? He has them surrounded. He has them outnumbered. And they say, look, give us a week. Let us try to bring all of B'nai Yisrael as reinforcements, and if they do not come and save us in a week, then we will surrender. Why on earth does he agree? It doesn't make any sense. Now, he is coming out of nowhere. Why is he attacking Yavesh Gilad now? What's the significance of Yavesh Gilad? Why is he asking them, demanding that they pierce out their right eyes? And Why is he giving them a week to find reinforcements? Why do they even think he would give them a week to find reinforcements? It's so bizarre that he says yes to the request. It's bizarre that they even think to ask for it. So something strange is going on. So we'll look at the Malbim. Malbim is going to have a phenomenal explanation. First, we just need to look at the map to get our bearings and see where this whole thing actually is. So to move the picture up the slide for a second. Here we go. So Yavesh Gilad is on the other side of the Jordan River. It's in the Gilad, right? Land of Menashe. then you have the land of Gad to the south. So these people are from Shevet Shevet Menashe. Yeah? You have Ammon, right? Rabat B'nai Ammon. That's where modern day Amman, right, the capital of Jordan, is over here. So they're having this struggle, and we're going to see. You know, B'nai Yisrael are going to end up coming to their rescue. That's the arrows over here. But the Yavesh Gilad all the way out over here. Now, the Yavesh Gilad has a history, and it goes back to Pilegesh Begiva. And Pilegesh Begiva is going to be the critical theme of the whole Parak Yud Aleph. At the end of the story of Pilegesh Begiva, after the B'nai Yisrael wipe out almost all of Shevet Binyamin, except for 600 men. So now they realize, oh, whoops, we just genocided the tribe of Binyamin. There's no way they can come back. We all swore that they would not marry our daughters. So they try to figure out a solution. And the first thing they say is, oh, well, the people living in Yavesh Gilad from Shevet Menashe did not join the call to the battle. So let's turn on Yavesh Gilad, wipe out the men of Yavesh Gilad, and then the survivors of Binyamin can marry the women of Yavesh Gilad. So what that means, and then they have 400 women from Yavesh Gilad, so the two-thirds of the survivors of Binyamin marry into Yavesh Gilad, and then the rest marry people from the rest of B'nai Yisrael. Okay. So that's So Binyamin and Yavesh Gilad have a history. So the Malbim says that this unlocks everything. Malbim says, remember, Shaul has just been crowned king. Now let's put ourselves in the shoes of this Nachash, the king of Ammon. Ammon is not a big country; it's pretty small. Right? They live in the, you know, what Jordan looks like. It's not such fertile land. They don't have many big cities or rivers. They're you know, somewhat nomadic, hard scrabble nation. Remember, Ammon and Moab they're linked. There's a reason why Balak, the king of Moab, freaks out when B'nai Yisrael approach Eretz Yisrael, because B'nai Yisrael are much, much larger than Ammon or Moab. So the prospect of a united monarchy, all these Shvatim who've been squabbling and divided the whole time of the Shoftim, the prospect of them uniting is terrifying strategically if you're Ammon. So Malbim says that basically Nachash decides he's going to try to strangle the program of monarchy from the get-go. So what's he going to do? Brilliant. Well, the people of Yavesh Gilad, attacking them is a great way. It's a great way to potentially undermine the whole Shaul's whole program. He says, let's see. Who are Yavesh Gilad? Yavesh Gilad, they have no friends among B'nai Yisrael. They live out in the boondocks. They don't even have any Shevet relationships with anyone. The only people they're connected to are Shevet Binyamin. Because Ki B'nei Binyamin lachu neshehem, after the whole event of Giva. And he says, presumably, so who now lives in Yavesh Gilad? Well, presumably, the men of Binyamin marry the women of Yavesh Gilad. The houses are all there. The fields are all there. So presumably, you have Binyamin people who move out to Yavesh Gilad. You have like a Shevet Binyamin colony out here in the boondocks. So here's the political challenge for Shaul. Is he going to be the king of all of B'nai Yisrael? Or is he just going to use B'nai Yisrael as a way to further the narrow interests of his own tribe? And so Nachash sets a perfect trap. Because what's Shaul going to do? If he does nothing, because I can't look like I'm a partisan for Binyamin by bringing everyone to help the isolated small community of Yavesh Gilad, then he's going to be exposed as a weakling. But if he tries to bring everyone, they're going to say, okay, you're only trying to use us to help your own tribe. It's a perfect trap. I think the Dat Mikra, if not, as someone else pointed out, that that also explains the symbolism of him demanding that they pierce their right eyes, because it refers to Ben Yamin, right? It's the symbolism of Ben Yamin. He's going after a little piece of Ben Yamin, and that is the exact strategy in which he's just trying to hamstring Shaul at the get-go. That is the trap. And he's very happy to give them 7 days. On the Rabbah, he gives them a month because he wants to show up Shaul and the attempt at creating a unified monarchy right here. So he's very happy to give them a week. He has no real interest in Yavish Gilad per se. What is Yavish Gilad? It's two streets and a stop sign, middle of the desert. He's not very interested in conquering Yavish Gilad for the sake of Yavish Gilad. He's interested in it for the sake of totally undermining the project that Shaul is trying to launch with all of Bnei Israel. Now, there's one other big piece to keep in mind, and we'll see this coming forward. Maybe next week we'll go into the battle in depth. But there's another reason why this is a phenomenal trap for Shaul, because not only are we dealing with this place Yavish Gilad that has a history of Pilegesh Begiva, and they're just a colony of Binyamin. Throughout Sefer Shoftim, it became clear that there was a major rift, a literal geographic rift in Bnei Yisrael, between those who lived on the Eretz Yisrael side of the Jordan River and those who lived in Eber Hanar. There's a reason why Moshe Rabbeinu was very unhappy with the prospect of the 2.5 tribes living on the other side of the Jordan River. There's a reason why there's almost a civil war at the end of Sefer Yehoshua. And you have that happen a couple times in Sefer Shoftim, culminating in the story of Yiftach. Yiftach, who is also from Gilad, also fights Amon on the other side of the Jordan River. And at the end of Yiftach's career, Yiftach has a civil war with the people of Ephraim on the Jordan River. And he massacres thousands of people from Ephraim at the crossings of the Jordan. So there's a Binyamin versus everyone else history over here, tension. There's also an Eber HaYarden versus the Israel side of the Jordan River tension over here. We have the echoes of Yiftach, and we're going to see that a lot of what Shaul is going to do is going to kind of evoke and really redeem, counteract the dark legacies of Yiftach and the dark legacy of Pilegesh Begiva. So that's all coming out of the Malbim. That seems to be the strategy and the challenge for Shaul. So what is Shaul going to do? So we have these three psukim here. So the Navi says in Pasuk Dalet, "Vayavau hamalachim givat Shaul." So those messengers from Yavesh Gilad were sent right here. We have it, Givat Shaul. Now it's called the hill of Shaul, right? So that's Shaul's new capital city. By Davruat Vrim Bez Neha'am, and they told the people there what happened. Vayasu kola am eskolam vayevku. Everyone hears what's happening, and they all burst out in tears. This is a scene that should sound familiar, because this is exactly what happened in Shiloh. The Ish Binyamin, we explained why Rashi told us that it was Shaul, but the fugitive from the battle came to Shiloh, came to the capital city, told everyone what happened, and then they all burst out in wailing. So that's essentially what you have here. The messengers come to the capital city, they tell the people, and then who's the last person to find out? In Parak Dalet of Sefer Shmuel, it was Eli. Eli is sitting blind, old, decrepit, in his chair, and he hears the whole city wailing, and Eli says, "What's going on?" And then finally the Ish Binyamin comes and tells him. So here you have something strikingly similar. The Navi says, "Bnei Shaul ba me'acharei habakar min ha'sadeh." Shaul is just coming back home from the fields. You know, he was crowned king in Perek Yud, but hasn't really changed him so much. He's still a farmer. He's out in the fields. He's not getting the regular national security reports. And he's the last person in the whole city to find out what's happening. Vayomer Shaul, ma la'am ki yivku? Why is everyone crying? Vayisapru lo es divrei anshei Yavesh. And they told him what happened. So this is like exactly similar to Ailey. But the similarity is only there to set up the difference. Because of course, when Ailey found out what happens, so he just collapses on the spot, falls backwards off of his chair, and that's the end. But for Shaul, this is going to be just the beginning. What's Shaul's reaction? Pasuk Vav, Batitzlach Ruach Elokim al Shaul. Once again, the spirit of Hashem rests on Shaul. Remember, that happened in Parak Yud when he became a Navi. It happens again over here. Kishnuah said the Rema Eila, Vayichar Apo Me'od. We see energy, anger, vigor. I think the only other time in Tanakh we have a person who we say Vayichar Me'od is Moshe when he reacts to Dasan and Aviram in the Korach rebellion. So the exact opposite of falling off his chair, passivity, hesitation, humility where it doesn't belong, Shaul is going to immediately leap into action. Now, what is Shaul going to do? I guess with this we'll close. So, what does Shaul do? Pasuk Zayin, Vayigach Tzemed Bakar. Sorry, he just came in from the fields with his cattle. Vaynat Chayu, and he slices up the oxen. So he shachts them and cuts them into pieces. Vayishalach b'chol gevul Yisrael. He sends the oxen to the whole all of Eretz Yisrael. Vayal b'alachim limor. Asher inenu yotzei acharei Shaul v'achar Shmuel. Anyone who doesn't follow Shaul and Shmuel, ko yaselef garav. Just like we severed up these oxen, we're going to slice up your oxen as well. Vayipol pachad Hashem ala am ve'itzu ki ish achad. They all, the dread of Hashem fell on everyone, and they all went out as one man. Bechim and Bazek, so they gathered together. So there's a ton to unpack here. I think it might be worth it to really just hold it and then come back and reattack this tomorrow, and that's tomorrow, next week. But just one point off the bat to immediately note, which is, what does the Navi say? Vayipol pachad Hashem al ha'am. The first act of Shaul as a king is instilling the fear of Hashem on the people. And that's outstanding, right? Shmuel's whole concern was that the people were going to abandon Hashem and exclusively pursue the leadership of a king. Shaul, in this moment, and this is going to be his greatest moment, jumps into action unhesitatingly, takes the lead, and from what he does, he instills, it's not, Mitzvah Stavit says, it's not pachad, it's not pachad, people are not afraid for their cattle, it's not they're afraid of Shaul, they are afraid of Hashem. They do not want to rebel against the one who Hashem has anointed. So we see here, off the bat, Shaul is rising to the challenge. It also sounds like he's addressing the concerns that Shmuel had. Next week, we'll unpack these a little more, and then we'll go and see the rest of how Shaul rises to the challenge in Perek Yud Aleph. Can this evoke? There's one question right here. Can this evoke Brit Milah v'Tarim? Very interesting. Let's talk about that next week. Next week, we'll talk about what is the symbolism of splitting up the animals. What is he trying to get at there? There's like a ton going on. And so, yeah, we'll investigate that next week. Yashar Koch. Okay. Thanks for coming. And looking forward to
Thank you. Week. Thank you.